The following live presentation by Rabbi Benny Friedman is brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To learn more about Israelite, please visit our website at www.israelite.org. Additional contact information is available at the end of this presentation. Thank you for learning with Israelite and enjoy the experience.
So this is an interesting portion, and it actually introduces a topic which is somewhat challenging, especially because it's so central to Judaism. Right? I mean, this is one of those pinnacles. If I could pick, there's like two or three central, I guess, pieces of the Jewish puzzle that everyone is aware of, but most people don't really connect to. Right? Sacrifices is one of them, which we're going to get into in a few weeks, God willing. You know, everybody knows that there's this concept of sacrifices. Most of us have difficulty relating to them. And this week we get introduced to one of those topics, which is the temple, the Beit HaMikdash, right? It's this thing out there that we're supposed to be yearning for. But if you sit down to talk to people about what it really is and why we really need it, people have a tough time with that. And maybe just to introduce you, I'll just tell you a good example of sort of one of the central themes that revolves around the temple. You know, this week's portion, Truma, begins really a sort of a five-portion unit, which appears at the end of the book of Exodus, the book of Shemot, which is really five portions, with the exception of the story of the golden calf, that form the bulwark of what's called the tabernacle, the Mishkan. Now, the tabernacle was I guess some people call it the tent of meeting. We're going to use the word Mishkan, but I'll try to keep translating it because I know people sometimes come on board in the middle. But basically, this is some form of a temporary temple, right? This is the original palm notion. You have this big temple one day that gets built in Jerusalem. This is sort of a mini version, so you could call it the palm temple, right? You take it with you, you fold it up, you can use it when you need it. It's out there in the desert, right? And there's one piece that sort of gets introduced in this week's portion, which is a little bit difficult to understand, and I'll give you just an example. I think this is one of those topics that everybody really learns sort of in a different way, but maybe in terms of how I learned mine, I remember we had this, there was this, you know, this obstacle course that they had us do when I was in the Army, in officer's course. It's like one of those lessons that you learn the hard way, but you never really forget, right? In infantry officers training, there's an obstacle course in a place called Wingate, the Wingate Institute. And it's known as a Sun Teva, which literally means a freak of nature. And that is a very appropriate name for this particular visit to hell. No cadet can graduate officer's course without completing this test. And we were made to do a number of dry runs before the actual test day. But being dry had absolutely nothing to do with it. Basically in full uniform with all your gear, with your gun slung over your back. At one point in this obstacle course, you have to wade through this ice-cold river that gets up to your chest. And when you wade out, the first thing that hits you is a 6-meter rope that you have to climb. And you're soaked from the river. You have all this extra weight of the water in your gears and on your clothes, not to mention the psychological pressure of the fact that there are guys behind you and commanders screaming at you, and that rope looms up at you like some insurmountable mountain. And 6 meters doesn't sound like, you know, 18 feet, like a tremendous amount when you're sitting on the phone, but when you're looking up at 18 feet of rope, and you have to climb this to the top with all your gear on you, and you're soaked in the river, and you're exhausted, it's just, you can't imagine that you're ever going to succeed in climbing this rope. You only have so much time to finish the entire course. Which means basically in order to do this, you have a little less than a minute to get up that rope. Or you don't make the grade, and you have to do the entire course over again. Right? And if you don't make the grade and get this obstacle course done within the right amount, I think it was 17 minutes, then you fail the course, you can't graduate as an officer. Even if you do everything else right. And I remember every time I never thought I would make it up that rope. I mean, I could get to the top, but to get to the top in the amount of time that they gave you, I just didn't imagine that it could be done. But there was this officer who was responsible for running us through the drill and teaching us, like, you know, the finer arts of the course. He was there on the final day when the test would count. I remember he was the guy who taught us how to throw ourselves at the wall and get over the wall. And he was this short little guy who wore a paratrooper beret, and throughout all his training, I had wondered, like, how he made it through all his training. I mean, he could have been more than 5 feet tall. And just before we began the run, he walked over to me, I guess he saw the tension on my face, and he said with this big grin, "Im tirtzu, en zo agada," and he walked away. This is a famous line from Theodor Herzl, who, when he was asked 100 years ago how he could devote himself to this fairy tale legend that the Jewish people, without the support of a single nation on the face of the earth, would somehow return to the land of Israel and build their own state, he basically replied, "Im tirtzu, if you want it enough, en zo agada, it will not remain a legend." And I got it. You don't climb ropes with muscle, you climb them with willpower. Now this topic, this willpower, is really one of the central themes of the whole issue of building a temple, having a tabernacle. And let's see if we can explain how this connects. Right? The Jewish people leave Mount Sinai behind them. They're in the middle of the desert. The Jewish people are given a new challenge. In this week's portion, Truma, right, Hashem asks of us basically to build for him a Mishkan, right? This sort of sanctuary here on earth, right? And this Mishkan, this tabernacle, had a very interesting precondition to being built, right? The verse says, this is in Parakafei Pasuk Bet, 25, verse 2, V'yikhu li Truma, me'et kol ish asher yidvenu libo, tikhu et Trumati. You tell the Jewish people that they should take from me an offering from each individual that will, whose heart desires, asher yidvenu libo, whose heart, I don't know, gives him sort of this desire to donate. In fact, the modern word for donation is a nidava, right? That's who you take these offerings for. And these offerings basically speak about, you know, the different, the monies that were donated to, you know, to buy the animals, and the materials that needed to be donated, gold and silver and whatever else was used to build the Mishkan, right? Et cetera, right? Moshe is given a clear imperative to collect from the Jewish people all the money and the material necessary to build a Mishkan. And yet, he can only collect from those who give voluntarily. Now that's a very interesting question. Was this a command to volunteer? Or was there no obligation to donate unless a person was moved to do so? In other words, are the Jewish people being asked to donate, or are they being told to donate? And in fact, it's interesting, the mitzvah, the commandment to build a mikdash, a temple, is actually a biblical obligation. And it's certainly one of the 613 mitzvot that's listed in the Torah. As a matter of fact, Maimonides, in his Laws of the Temple, his Hilchot Beit HaBechira, right at the beginning, chapter 1, halacha, law number 1, right, lists this as an obligation. And it's also the 20th positive commandment in his Book of Mitzvot, right, which is actually based on the on Pasuk Chet, on verse 8, in the beginning of this week's portion. So there is a mitzvah to build the temple, which raises the question as to what this, I don't know, enforced volunteerism was all about. I mean, what would have happened if no one had volunteered to donate the necessary materials? Apparently, there would have been no Beit HaMikdash, no temple. So it would seem that one of the most crucial ideas in Judaism, the Beit HaMikdash, the temple, is completely dependent on the whim and fancy of the Jewish people, something which needs to be understood. Even more challenging, by the way, is that the building of the Mishkan, the tabernacle, which was again this temporary tent of meeting in the desert, and later the Mikdash, the temple, also seems to run counter to one of the basic principles of Judaism. Most of the major rabbinic authorities concur that in general, mitzvot einan tzrichot kavana, which means that a mitzvah does not require intent, right? It's an interesting question. Ultimately, the fulfillment of a mitzvah is dependent upon the commission of an action, and not on the kavana or the intent that's meant to accompany. In other words, if I'm hungry, right, if I'm not hungry all day on Yom Kippur, and because I'm not hungry, I end up fasting the entire day, despite having no idea that it is Yom Kippur, or that there's a mitzvah to fast on that day, I nonetheless fulfill the mitzvah. Because in the end, I have fasted on Yom Kippur, right? If you want to go to a water park, and I don't know, I remember there used to be this great water park near the Dead Sea called Kalia, and they have the most incredible water slides, right? So they used to have this deal in the summertime, starting with the spring, because it's very hot down there. They wanted to encourage business that if you came after, I think it was like 3 in the afternoon, that you could stay until 10 p.m., and it was like half price, right? So all the cheap Jews like me, you know, we take our kids down at like 3-4 in the afternoon. And it was very clever, because then the place got really crowded at like 4 or 5 in the afternoon, so all the people who'd come in the morning left, and then they had a full park until 10 o'clock at night. So imagine that you're down there, and it's night, and you're really enjoying yourself, and you're going down the slide, down this water slide. And unbeknownst to you, there are two guys at the bottom of the water slide, and they're playing frisbee. And they happen to be playing frisbee with a piece of matzah, okay? And it's the night of Passover. They're playing frisbee with this piece of matzah. It's the night of Passover, the night of the Seder. And you come flying off the slide. The matzah's in midair. It's a Wide World of Sports moment. And boom, into your mouth goes the matzah, and you eat the proper amount of matzah that you're obligated to eat on the night of the Seder. Now, it's a meaningless experience. You don't even know that it's Passover. You don't know that it's the Seder. You get nothing out of it. So I'm not saying that that's the way the mitzvah is meant to be fulfilled, but technically, you fulfill the mitzvah. To the extent that if later on you decide that you want to have a Seder and you want to eat a piece of matzah, you don't make the blessing on the mitzvah because you already did it, right? Jump into a pool to swim and it happens to be a mikvah, same deal. But in this case, in the case of the temple, it's apparent that without the intent or the kavanah, the mitzvah is meaningless. If I donate all the gold and silver in the world for the mikdash, for the temple, but I just want to clear out my warehouse, and I have no intention of donating this material for the purpose of building a temple, my mitzvah is meaningless. In fact, just to underscore this point, the Rambam, Maimonides again, in his Laws of the Temple, in his Hilchot Beit HaBechira, I think it's the 20th halacha in the first chapter, says a very interesting thing. Every stone that was used for the temple had to be quarried for the purpose, the express purpose of building the temple, right? And if you had great stones that had been quarried for some other purpose, you couldn't use them for the temple, right? And Rashi, by the way, on our verse here, right, on the word li, which means for my name, right? Ikhu li truma, let them take from me an offering, truma, right? All these things that we're donating. Rashi says that li means for my name, and it really means li lishmi, for the purpose of my name, right? In other words, everything you donate has to be for the purpose of building the tabernacle or the temple. So this mitzvah of building the Mishkan, the tabernacle, more than any other mitzvah, is entirely dependent on the desire of the individual. In fact, Rav Avigdor Nevenzel points out in his sichot, in his conversations on this topic, that we don't usually find this in most other commandments. Even where the intent of the mitzvah is important, one usually doesn't see this intent at such an early stage. For example, even though a get, a Jewish divorce contract, if when it's written, God forbid, on a scroll by a scribe, so he has to write it with the intent of fulfilling the mitzvah of writing a get. He can't just, you know, write a Jewish divorce contract because he's practicing calligraphy, right? It has to be written for the purpose of the mitzvah. But even in that mitzvah, the parchment itself doesn't have to be made for the purpose of a get. You just go out and get some parchment. But in this case, you actually have to quarry the stones. In other words, this mitzvah is so wrapped up, right? What makes this mitzvah, building a temple, so different from other mitzvot that it so depends on the desire of the individual fulfilling it? Especially when you consider that the blanket statement in the Talmud is that a person should always, there's a Talmudic discussion in Psachim on the 50th folio, which we're actually going to get to soon in Daf Yomi, that Le'olam, a person should always be involved with Torah and mitzvot, commandments, even when the motivation is not purely for the sake of the mitzvah, right? Lishma, because things done without a pure motivation will eventually lead to things that are done with a pure motivation. Mitoch shelo lishma ba lishma. So Judaism clearly suggests that what I do has a powerful effect on who I am. And ultimately, even on my thought process, on my motivation, on my intentions. Right? If you want to become a better person, suggests Jewish tradition in a variety of sources, behave as though you already are that better person, and you will ultimately become that better person. You know, you're not a particularly giving person, so you're not used to giving tzedakah, and you want to become a more giving person, just practice giving tzedakah, even if you don't feel it. Even if you're not a generous person, and you will become a generous person. Etc., etc. So why is this not true when you build the temple? Now, it's interesting to note that there are actually other instances where we have this issue. In other words, where the mitzvah, according to the same sources, does indeed require intent as a prerequisite to fulfillment. For example, if I'm out for a run, one fine Rosh Hashanah day, and I'm passing the local synagogue and I hear the shofar blowing, and I have not fulfilled the mitzvah, right? So unless I know that it's Rosh Hashanah, and I intend to fulfill the mitzvah when hearing the shofar, I don't fulfill the mitzvah. Right? If you're running by a synagogue, and you're jogging in the morning, you have no idea it's Rosh Hashanah, and you hear this weird sound, you know, and you stop to listen because you think it's nice. And only later on you find out it's Rosh Hashanah, you didn't fulfill the mitzvah of shofar. You can actually later on blow the shofar, make a blessing, the whole nine yards. So of course the question is, well, why is that different from, let's say, the matzah example that I gave? So Rav Chaim Brisker, who was the rabbi in Brisk, the grandfather of Rav Soloveitchik, who passed away a number of years ago, he suggests very simply that unlike other mitzvot, right, sometimes it's not that there's a mitzvah to do, and the question is, do you have the proper feeling or intention to the mitzvah, right? Rather, sometimes the mitzvah is the feeling. In other words, when I blow shofar, it's not that I'm blowing shofar and that's the mitzvah, and the question is, what do I feel? The whole mitzvah is what I feel when I'm blowing the shofar. The shofar is just the vehicle to get me to feel. By the way, this is true with prayer as well, right? If I pray, but I have no intent, I don't know what I'm saying, I don't really fulfill the mitzvah, because the whole purpose of the mitzvah, right? The whole purpose of the mitzvah is the intent that I feel, right? Without the desire and understanding of what prayer is all about, I am in fact not even close to fulfilling the mitzvah, which is why Maimonides rules in much the same way regarding prayer, as he does with shofar, that without the proper intention and feeling, you cannot fulfill the mitzvah, because the mitzvah is to experience that feeling. Right? If I'm just saying the words without any accompanying thought process or desire, then there is, it seems, really no point to praying. And by the way, the same thing with the shofar. If the shofar doesn't motivate me to become a better person and return to tshuva, to who I was meant to be, then I'm missing the essence of the mitzvah of shofar. All of which really brings us back and points us to the fact that the mitzvah of building the mikdash can't be fulfilled without the proper desire, without the proper intent. Then somehow what that means is that the building of the mishkan, the devotion and the intention is the mitzvah. In other words, it must be, if we follow this line of reasoning, that the reason that intent... somebody's talking in the background. That the reason that the intent is so critical to building the temple is because somehow the intent is the mitzvah. Which leaves us wondering why the Beit HaMikdash, why the temple would be considered meaningless if it was built...
Jimmy?
Yeah?
There's one aspect which I'm not sure of over here.
Okay.
If somebody intends to do a mitzvah, right. I intend to give tzedakah, I intend to do chesed.
Right.
And as I'm going, a snowstorm comes, something blocks me. I always thought that if you had the intent to do the mitzvah, but you were blocked by external forces, you were not part of the mitzvah. Is that not true?
So that's a different aspect. That's called anus rachmana patri. In other words, if somebody intends to do a mitzvah, right, and some external factor prevents him from doing that mitzvah, you know, like what you said, like if I want to fast on Yom Kippur, right, and I have all the desire and intent and the meaning to do it, and God forbid I'm in the Holocaust and the Nazis force me to eat, right, so I've not missed the mitzvah in the sense that I still have to fulfill it. Right? However, that's the opposite case. That's a case where I have the intent, but I don't have the action. If the reason that I don't have the action has nothing to do with me, then on a mystical level, right, I have fulfilled the mitzvah. By the way, even in a case like that, right, if I have the intent and some external factor prevents me from fulfilling the mitzvah, if nonetheless, later on I get the chance to fulfill the mitzvah, I can still fulfill the mitzvah. So that's a mystical question. But here we're talking about the opposite. Here we're talking about where I am doing the action, but I have no intention. And there are two types of mitzvot. There's a mitzvah where the action is the essence of the mitzvah, and the intent just adds to the mitzvah. It's what I get out of the mitzvah. It's how I make the mitzvah more meaningful. So then even though the ideal, obviously, is that I have intention and I understand the meaning, nonetheless, the purpose of the mitzvah is to give me intent. So even though I may not have the full intention, since the purpose of the mitzvah is to give me that intention, I still fulfill the mitzvah because it has an impact on me, right? However, sometimes the mitzvah is a mitzvah where the essence of the mitzvah is the intention, like prayer. The whole point of prayer is what I'm feeling and what I'm thinking about. So if I'm not feeling and I'm not thinking about, right? If you took a guy in a coma and you made it and you got him to say the words, it wouldn't be a meaningful prayer because he wouldn't be thinking about it, right? So, but getting us back to our question in terms of the temple, right? Why would the temple, the building of the Beit HaMikdash, be considered meaningless if it were built or even planned without the proper desire or intent? What's the difference if the stones are quarried for the purpose of building the temple or not? And of course, deeply intertwined with this question is the larger question, which we can allude to, though I don't know what we're going to resolve, regarding the building of a temple to begin with. Why does God, in the end, require such a space? Right? What does it mean, in fact, that there is a place where I can connect with God more than any other place? I mean, isn't God everywhere? Why do I need a temple? And by the way, why is this mitzvah given to the Jewish people here, almost immediately after Sinai, in the middle of the desert? So, to place this in its proper perspective, I think it's important to note that there's a fascinating debate as to the relationship between this mitzvah to build a tabernacle and the sin of the golden calf. Okay, this is a fascinating debate. Rashi, Rav Shlomo Yitzchaki, who was a medieval commentator, suggests that the whole idea of building a tabernacle was given as a result of the mistake of the golden calf. In other words, you want to connect to God through the tangible world, right? We're going to talk about this when we get to the portion of the golden calf in a couple weeks, right? But because you sinned with the golden calf, therefore, I'm going to let you build a temple and have some tangible form to worship me. However, the Ramban, Nachmanides, who lives about 200 years or 150 years after Rashi, he vehemently disagrees, maintaining that chronologically this mitzvah was given before the sin of the golden calf. Right? So, consequently, the Jewish people are given the opportunity to build a tabernacle, to build a Mishkan, while they're still on the verge of entering the land of Israel. And building the tabernacle becomes a necessary prerequisite to entering the land. Somehow the Mishkan, the tabernacle, like the temple later on, are intimately connected to entering and living in the land of Israel. Why was the temple only necessary in Israel? Now, obviously, God doesn't need a temple. In point of fact, God doesn't need at all. Right? The concept of needing implies a deficiency that needs to be filled, and obviously God has no deficiencies, and God doesn't need space in general, including the particular space of a temple. It's obvious that God doesn't need a temple. We need the temple. The Mishkan, the tabernacle, is our introduction to the concept of elevating the spaceless through space, of reaching the unlimited through the defined. Let me say that again. The Mishkan, the tabernacle, is our introduction to reaching the unlimited through the defined. And that in and of itself is a whole discussion. Sometimes we need tangible vehicles with which to begin to access the intangible. Everything about the temple, everything about the tabernacle, the Mishkan, was designed to arouse our desire to become better, to be better. The detail of the artwork, the nature of the materials that are used, the ideas behind the functions of different vessels, not to mention all the details of the process of offering up sacrifices, all of this was designed to elevate a human being to a different consciousness. The essence of the service in the temple was what a person felt and not what he was doing. If the building was all about stones, if it wasn't about how that environment caused a person to be, if it didn't change who you were, right, then what was the point? The goal was a rediscovery of who we could be and a reawakening to what we were meant to become. So if a person was going through all the right motions, but it wasn't combined with an arousal of the heart, then he had missed the point. He was missing the essence of the entire mitzvah of building a temple. Right? The mikdash, the temple, was basically meant to be a lesson in the effect of the right environment on all that we do and all that we are. And this is also the essence of the idea that we as a people need to be in such an environment. And on a national level, that means the land of Israel all the time. Right? That's why there's a connection between the two. And by the way, on a practical level, this is a powerful idea. Because, you know, we are very much influenced by our environment. But we don't always pay attention to that. You know, the client comes to the office, you go into the boardroom, you go into the conference room, and you make sure that there's a beautiful table. And that's the room with the nicest view. Right? because you want to be able to have the solid discussion and you want to be able to impress people with your office, right? If we have a party, if we go to a restaurant, everything is about ambiance. And we're very much affected by where we are. And that has an impact on who we are. And one wonders, interestingly enough, whether this idea goes even deeper. Sometimes an action that's done without the necessary motivation does far more than render the action meaningless. Sometimes such an action can actually damage the soul. And the example, by the way, par excellence of this is actually the mitzvah of living in Israel. There is no doubt that at least in the Torah, a Jew's place is in the land of Israel. And that ideally, that's the dream of the Jewish people to come home to the land of Israel. And I think, and maybe I'm wrong here, you'll tell me in a few minutes when we open up the floor, but I think that, you know, ultimately, even Jews who live overseas, and even Jews who may not right now have an intention to live in Israel, they understand that essentially, that Israel is the place of the Jewish people, and that's why they visit Israel, and that's why they support Israel, etc. And that's why they want there to be a state of Israel. And there are a great number of mitzvot that one fulfills in Israel, simply in the day-to-day of living there. Right? There's no obligation to tithe your fields in America, only in Israel. There's no sabbatical year in America, only in Israel. So now that's very interesting. Why then, when the Jews' behavior was distancing them from God, and God destroys the temple, why does God exile us from the land of Israel? I would have thought that at the very least, if the Jews were living in Israel, they'd be fulfilling a whole bunch of commandments of mitzvot, even without the proper intent. You know? Wouldn't we be better off staying at least in the right environment? Unless you say that perhaps once we as a people are no longer fulfilling the essence of the mitzvah of living in Israel, right? We're not living and breathing the essence of the mitzvah we were given in the temple. We had to lose those mitzvah. Because to perform them, and of course at this instance they actually become a performance instead of the real McCoy, to perform them without really fulfilling them would have been destructive to who we are as a people, which is something Rav Kook discusses. And if this is so, maybe any mitzvah whose essence is the service of the heart, of Avodah Shebalev, becomes destructive if we allow it to become divorced from the heart, whose inspiration forms the basis for that mitzvah. One wonders how destructive a prayer service, mumbled without meaning, where the rabbi gets hoarse yelling at everybody to stop talking, can be. Right? And you wonder whether it was this type of performance, devoid of any feeling or desire, that led so many Jews to leave the beauty of mitzvot behind, in search of disciplines that would bring back the fire and the joy they thirsted for. Right? Much like the actor who can't fulfill his role in the performance if he's devoid of passion, it's the passion of the heart which forms the core of what Judaism is meant to be. Right? We look at the temple as a building made of stone, filled with gold. But that's just an illusion. The essence of the Mikdash of the temple is the love and the joy, the desire that we have to come closer to God in this world. And it's interesting that more than in any other place, Judaism, the temple, actually brought all the different Jews together. When you went into the courtyard of the temple, you know, there was no left wing or right wing or reform or orthodox. There was no such thing. And with all the problems we ever had, we never built more than one temple. Never existed. That was a mistake we made in the exile. And that's the foundation on which the world can become holy, and which can allow each and every one of us to bring God into this world. And the truth is that we never get all the way there until we're united as a people in our own land with the home that we've been promised. Maybe because ultimately we can only go so far in this world. But if we get as far as we can on our own, maybe God meets us halfway. And maybe together as a united people, we can build our own home with God as a partner. And that work really begins, and we're almost done, with each and every one of us building our own Mikdash Me'at. Every Jew is called a mini temple, a Mikdash Me'at. Each person has to build his own world based on love and harmony and joy and belief. And that desire is really the beginning of the process which affects the entire world. Right? Never underestimate the power of the joy and desire of a single individual. You know? And you meet people sometimes like that. You meet people who struggle with life. I remember a couple years ago there was a boy, amazing boy. His name was Mikey Butler. And he had cystic fibrosis. And we became close with his family when we were in Pittsburgh. And his struggle was just an unbelievable struggle. It was a thing to behold. And I remember his bar mitzvah and you know, just how he elevated an entire community. You know? And his struggle, the challenge of building that Mikdash Me'at, of that temple, of creating that, you know, that world of joy and beauty, however difficult it seemed, I remember always being reminded whenever I was around him that it's not about where you are, it's really about who you are. And his and his family's ability to keep smiling despite all of their ordeals, it taught everybody who ever watched them, and I'm sure this is just my personal example, but I'm sure everybody here has an example like that. Somebody you've met who succeeded in teaching you that we can create our own little temple wherever we are and however we are. And that while we don't get to choose the world we're given, we are absolutely masters of the world we choose to live in. You know, we have the ability to become much more than the person that we are. We can actually become a mikdash. We can become a place for others to be with as well. And maybe that's why God gives us this challenge immediately after Sinai, in the middle of the desert. Because who you are is not really about where you are. It's about where you choose to be. You know, so often we're overwhelmed by the circumstances that surround us, that allow the daily challenges to become the essence of our reality. And maybe the portion of Truma, this week's portion, comes to remind us that reality isn't just something we're given, it's something that we're partners in creating. You know, me'eit kol ish asher yidvenu libo, says God, from each person whose heart desires to give. The foundation of all that we do is the essence of what we really want. What do we want? This is the question God asks us to consider as we embark on the building of the Mishkan and later of the Mikdash, the temple. And if we want to be in a place that will awaken in us the thirst for a better world and the belief that we can be partners in creating it, then the journey begins inside each one of us. The bricks and mortar, the gold and silver, those are just the trappings. The real building begins with the heart.
This presentation by Rabbi Benny Friedman has been brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To access additional presentations from our online media library, order our best-selling books, or learn more about Israelite programming, including seminars, web-based learning, teleconferences, spiritual retreats, Shabbaton experiences, Israel missions, and leadership training, please visit us at www.israelite.org. That's www.israelight.org. You can also call us in New York at 212-947-4990 or in Jerusalem at country code 972-2627-4890. We hope you enjoyed this presentation, and we look forward to learning with you at Israelite.